Sometimes our treatments are so good that we can't be just in a clinical trial, but have to see how the drug performs in the real world. That happens all the time with rare diseases. I'm Jeff Stewart from Syneos Health Consulting. I'm joined today by Ray Hummel, VP of Medical and Scientific Strategy and head of the Rare Disease Consortium, and Javier Jimenez, Executive Vice President of Real World Evidence and Late Phase, both here at Syneos Health. We'll be talking about how real-world evidence particularly helps in rare disease clinical trials. Real-world evidence and rare diseases next on the Syneos Health Podcast. Ray Hummel, Javier Jimenez, welcome to the Syneos Health Podcast.
Thanks, Jeff. It's a delight to be here.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here today.
I know both of you, but could you just tell the audience what you do?
I'm a Vice President of Medical and Scientific Strategy at Syneos Health. I'm also the head of the Rare Disease Consortium at Syneos Health, and I work in a virtual environment to connect the dots between folks within the company and outside the company for the benefit of sponsors who are developing products for rare diseases.
Yes, I'm the Executive VP for Real World Evidence at Syneos. I lead a team of experts in the design and implementation of real world evidence studies, helping to apply real world evidence across product life cycle to accelerate the development of product for patients.
So we're talking about rare diseases, and we're also talking about real world evidence. What is it that is true about rare diseases that makes us need real world evidence particularly? Why rare diseases? Why real world evidence?
Jeff, I think rare diseases by definition are rare, but collectively they're actually more common than what people think. For example, in the United States, about 1 out of 10 people actually has a rare disease.
Wait, what?
Yeah, it's actually true. About 1 out of 10 people have a rare disease in the United States, it's estimated. So over 30 million people have a rare disease in the United States. So while individually rare diseases are rare, collectively they're actually quite a large group. Typically, when people used to think of real world evidence, they try to think about augmenting the evidence for like a drug dossier, say, for example, for approval for a drug in the United States or Europe or elsewhere in any of the global markets. But increasingly, we use real-world evidence to augment trials and clinical trials because there's so few patients. We need to find out data from whatever source we can get it. And real-world evidence is one place we can do it. There's also different areas to get real-world evidence from. So some of the areas that might not come top to mind for folks that might be listening to this would be real-world evidence from, say, natural history studies or something like that. So there's a lot of places that we can get real-world evidence, and it's becoming increasingly important, not just in the post-approval process, but also prior to approval.
So rare diseases are rare, but collectively, maybe not so rare. What are we talking about when we're talking about real-world evidence? I know that we've had a couple of podcasts on real-world evidence. The very first podcast, the Syneos Health podcast, was on real-world evidence. What is real-world evidence? Just remind us.
Real-world evidence is information collected from the patients and for the management of the patient in the real-life management of the disease. Outside the environment of a clinical trial that is more forced by a protocol in the way that the patients are managed, real-world evidence is collecting this information in the day-to-day of the patient. So it's pretty important because clinical trials are really good to fully understand the effect of product and the value of the different product. But real-world evidence is critical to understand the disease progression and understand the impact of the disease on the patient.
Yeah, I could see the benefit of real-world evidence over clinical trial evidence because it's the real world. That's the whole point, is that what we do in the clinic, we want to apply to the real world. So it seems just better to have real world evidence. On the other hand, not controlled very well. Am I understanding the basic tension between clinical trial evidence and real world evidence?
Yeah,
Jeff, I think you're hitting on an important topic. The way you can look at it is that, you know, a lot of the trials that we look at in rare diseases, just by definition, are going to be in small numbers of patients, right? So it would not be uncommon to have a rare disease product approved on, say, less than 40 patients. So because there's such little information, it's hard for not only regulators, but also payers and reimbursers to try to make decisions or health economic outcome decisions based on such small data. So they want to augment that with additional data. Additionally, some of these products in rare diseases, like the complex rare gene therapy trials and things like that, are complex and they're specialized. And you know, when you alter DNA or RNA, the regulatory authorities sometimes can ask for 5, 10, or even more years of data in the post-approval setting. So to take that data out of a very complex controlled clinical trial data, which is highly valuable, and then augment it with real world data over a long period of time can give a lot more comfort to both regulators, payers, insurers, and others involved in the rare disease drug development process.
You know, that's interesting. If we're talking about payers and insurers, those that are paying for the drug, you can see why they might want real-world evidence. My understanding is that a lot of real-world evidence might get to the economic or personal impact on the patient. On the other hand, payers don't seem to care about a lot of that, at least in the U.S. So you might think that they would, but why would they? It's such a small slice of their budget. They don't usually ask for economic data and don't believe it when they get it. So I'm having a little bit of trouble in thinking about why would a payer care if at the end of the day, they have, say, 2 patients per million members or something like that, and it's not worth their time to figure out whether or not it's saving money or not saving money.
Well, the reality is, I think that they care more than what we could consider for different reasons. One of them is that also some of the rare disease patients can be in the system for years before they have a diagnostic, and they are using a lot of resources. They have a really not good experience of the system just because it's taking time to have the diagnosis. So, in fact, this is an area that is really a common interest. In better understanding the patient, diagnose the patient as soon as possible, and offer patient the best treatment because finally it will have an impact on the patient outcome, on the patient satisfaction, but also in the use of resources.
And is there a specific reason why real-world evidence and rare diseases go together? That's also a part that I'm not quite getting. I'm actually kind of seeing the opposite about why I might not want them together. Just help me out here, because this is the part that I don't get. Why do rare diseases imply that real-world evidence is particularly important? Or is it just a particular challenge?
Well, there is a couple of areas. One is the point that when you are trying to, when there is an interest in development, a new compound or a new medicine for a disease, is really important to fully understand what is the natural history and the progression of the disease. And this is the reason why it's so important to have natural history studies that collect this real-world evidence to collect the information. The other point is, in some of the situation, it will be even an ethical issue with having patients in the placebo arm of clinical trials. So having opportunity to enrich the clinical trial with real-world evidence can help to reduce the number of patients that could be required to be in a placebo arm, offering a better opportunity for the patient to receive the drug as soon as possible.
And that's because these drugs, because they're rare diseases, they often tend to be genetic diseases or ones that have a very high efficacy when they work, or no efficacy when they don't work. And so having somebody on a control arm or a placebo arm is wrong. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, there's a couple facets to that. And let me just help unbox that a little bit for you, Jeff. For the placebo arm, there's a couple things. One is no person who has rare disease who wants to go into trial really wants to get in the placebo arm, right? And the other thing too is that going back to the natural history course, some of these diseases are very slow, or you won't see a course for a very long period of time. So the natural history may take several years to get information until you can get an inflection to see when actually something worsens or to see when something happens. Obviously, it'd be different for something that happens very quickly. But for something that takes a very long time, if you could potentially be in a study, say, for a year, and the primary endpoint doesn't read out for a year, then you potentially would be not getting benefit from that treatment for an entire year. So there are things we can do. And by working together with the real-world evidence and biostatisticians, we can do things like maybe put an interim analysis so that we can take a peek at the study to see if it's working or not. If it's not working, you could shut it down for futility. And if it is working, then you could at least know that perhaps maybe another potential might be is if you don't get placebo during the trial, at least you know if it is working and it continues at the end of the year, that patient who's in the placebo arm could have access to it in, say, an open-label arm. So there are some tricks and things we can pull. The other thing about a placebo is most people think that you're either in a trial and you're either on the active or the placebo, and they think about a 1-to-1 randomization. But we can do things like that too. Like in rare diseases, you might think about doing a 1-to-2 or a 1-to-3 randomization ratio. And in some instances, that might make sense. So there are some ways to get around some of these things. But I think Javier has set it up very nicely that the natural history and placebo arm are two of the ones that come right to mind in rare disease drug development.
So let's say that I'm a pharma company. I'm developing a rare disease. And I want to know, should I be using real-world evidence? I'm kind of scared of using real-world evidence because I'm used to a clinical trial that's highly controlled, and I understand it. And I'm uncertain about real-world evidence being something I want to go down. Help convince me, or how do I know that this is the time I need real-world evidence? And if so, when?
And this is potentially one of the biggest misconceptions about real-world evidence that can be used only when you have already the product in the market. And this is the point about how real-world evidence, and in particular in rare disease through the research of the natural history and the disease history, can really help to identify the best design for the clinical development for the product, for understanding what is the best way to identify the patient and diagnose the patient with that particular disease, identify subtypes of the disease, and identify which outcomes are important for the patient, for regulator, and for payer to understand the efficacy or effectiveness of the product. So in fact, having this information can really help to develop and to have your clinical development program much more tailored and be more successful.
So earlier is important. Is there a particular rare disease or rare disease area, or how do I know that my rare disease belongs with real-world evidence as opposed to any disease or any rare disease?
In the rare disease space, I will say that almost any rare disease will require this real-world evidence, because you always need to have this information to really fully understand what is the natural history and the progression of the disease and understand how the patients are managed today, what are the outcomes that the patient are having. So really, if you want to have a good clinical development program for almost any rare disease, you need to have this information.
Yeah, and Jeff, another thing too, just to add to that, is that a lot of times with rare diseases, because it's so difficult to recruit these patients, because it's not just identifying patients, but it's actually convincing the patients who with the rare diseases to enroll in a clinical trial. So those are two different things. It's not just identifying the patients, but you have to convince them that the risk benefit is in their favor so that they enroll in the trials. So these are typically very small numbers. One of the situations in rare diseases that could occur is that a company might get tentative approval on a small subset of data, and part of that subset of data could be augmented with real-world evidence. And then later, they may need to show in another trial, like a post-approval trial, that they need to show clinically that maybe if, say, they have a biomarker, that the biomarker translates to actually having clinical relevance and provides a clinical benefit for final approval. Along that whole journey, though, it's not just enough to get the drug approved and on the market, but to get it to the patients who you wish to get it to. So again, it's not just a regulatory affair decision, but it could be a business decision to be able to augment your data with not just for approval, but also, like I say, for payers, reimbursement specialists, and also could convince physicians of all the information that they have regarding that drug at that time to make an informed decision on whether to prescribe that medication or not.
So it can help on the commercial side of the business. On the regulatory side, I know that in the 21st Century Cures Act, the agency was directed that they should accept real-world evidence. Are they playing nice? How are they being with real-world evidence? Or has it been something that we're feeling out and has been fits and starts? Or has it been fantastic?
Well, my understanding is that probably rare disease started to use real-world evidence earlier. So it's probably the experience of the use of real-world evidence in this environment, use of real-world evidence in other areas. And there are multiple examples where real-world evidence has been used to support regulatory approval for rare disease compound, either by using historical control, some situation, or using external control to complement some of the information.
Well, I love the idea of using historical control because you can have more patients on the active arm. I'm also a little surprised that they would allow that, though, just from a statistical side. I'm not used to historical controls being allowed. They are because they're rare diseases?
Yeah. Jeff, I was just going to say, you know, one of the things, too, is that when you think of classical or more prevalent disease drug development, you always think of maybe a p-value.
Sure.
And unfortunately, in rare disease, it doesn't necessarily always come down to a p-value. If you look at some of the approvals in DMD to date, at least two of them, like Exondys and Vorondys, they have both not yet proven efficacy in the clinic. But it's believed that because they have shown the biomarker dystrophin to increase within serum, that that will correlate with clinical benefits. So the FDA asked them, as to my earlier example, to actually have them do a post-approval study to actually show that there is a clinical benefit. So I think when some of these diseases that are life-threatening, like Duchenne muscular dystrophy, where typically a boy may last only until his 30s, that we realize that the urgency is there and that the FDA is taking unprecedented, in some cases, stance on how the evidence is supported and how it will be presented to the agency. And you also have to realize, too, that this is still early days. If I had to look at one marker for rare disease drug development and you asked me about one date, what's the most important in rare disease drug development in the history of mankind, I would say it would be the 1983 Orphan Drug Act. The reason I would say that is because the 10 years prior to 1983, there was 10 drugs approved for rare diseases. Since 1983, there's over 300 drugs approved with over 700 different rare disease indications. So we are making progress, but given that there's between 7 and 8,000 rare diseases, we still have a long way to go. So you have to realize we're kind of in early days here. It's not yet completely all figured out with real-world evidence. And I will say that in rare disease drug development in general, that there are some disagreement between even the FDA and EMA on which drugs should be approved and how they should be approved. So even though with the ICH community and a desire to strongly be together and be harmonized, it is difficult sometimes. And we also have different payer systems, which I think provides an influence, although I guess in the perfect world, it should be unbiased.
You know, I've seen some payers in the face of clinical data that really weren't fantastic, even in rare diseases, then not allow reimbursement. So usually with rare diseases, it doesn't matter very much because it's such a small budget item that payers don't really have the will to push back or the reason to. But in cases where the clinical evidence is really borderline, we've seen that. We've seen a few cases where rare diseases get excluded or held to the most stringent of the clinical trial criteria, the inclusion-exclusion criteria. Am I hearing from you that in those cases that real-world evidence can overcome that?
So the point is, you can have the product in the market and you can evaluate what is the effectiveness and safe product in the market in the real life, in the management of the patient. You can generate additional information that can be used to discuss with payer and to convince payer about the need to reimburse the product. Or you can enter into new mechanisms like value-based contracting, where you can agree on a way to pay for the product based on the outcome that it provides on real life. And those value-based contracting will require to have support of the real-world evidence about how the product is being used and what is the outcome that is seen in real life.
The way I look at it is it can augment an existing package and it can help convince, but it's not necessarily a silver bullet. It is increasingly being used. It's increasingly, we have case studies and surrogates, and it's increasingly being accepted by the agencies as a very valid tool. And there's been a lot of people that have worked for a lot of years to try to get it to this place. So I do think it is increasing in value, and it will continue to increase in value as people see additional case studies and see more of these natural history studies and especially different clinical trial designs incorporating real-world evidence.
You know, payer advocates are either the lifeblood of a lot of drugs, especially orphan diseases, or the nuclear war that can be brought by the pharma company in cases of insurers being problematic. Patient advocates and patients, how are they responding to real-world evidence?
I think in the old days, patient advocates were not as sophisticated, but you're increasingly getting more and more sophistication with the patient advocacy groups. It's true that many of the rare diseases are not represented by a patient advocacy group. So if you look at the 7,000 to 8,000 rare diseases, there's no real numbers that I've seen in the literature of late that gives you a specific number on how many are represented by a patient advocacy group. But I have looked at different surrogates, and it's probably not more than a couple of thousand patient advocacy groups for the 7,000 or 8,000 rare diseases that are out there. So for one thing, you have to realize that patient advocacy groups vary in sophistication and size, right? So some are very small. Some may only have a small handful of patients for ultra-rare diseases. And some, like Cystic Fibrosis Foundation or Muscular Dystrophy Association or some of the larger ones, may have a budget of greater than $100 million per year. So you're all going to have different sophistication in different levels. But I will tell you that patient advocacy groups are increasingly having a voice in not only drug approvals, but I think they're also trying to have a voice in the post-approval process and who gets what. You have to realize some of these products too are studied in only a specific subset of patients, like some of the exon amenable skipping technologies where it's only for a certain mutation. So if you get approved for just studying that mutation, some folks may argue that you could use it for all different things that's not being studied, and insurers may argue that you can only use it for a certain population that it's been studied in. So I think those will continue to have debate, and we'll continue to need additional evidence in order to make a convincing story. The story of health economics, too, used to be one that was left more in Europe than in the United States. But increasingly in the United States, we're having to come up with some of the same type of thinking that the Europeans are relying on now to see whether the risk-benefit is worth reimbursing for certain products. So I think it behooves every drug developer and every patient advocacy group trying to get either disease-modifying treatments or cures for their patients to try to augment and make sure that they have the best clinical drug development strategy that includes all triggers, including real-world evidence, to make sure that they have the best chance of getting the drug, once it is approved, to the largest number of patients within that disease state.
Well, I think that's probably a good place to stop. We'll leave it there. Ray Hummel, Javier Jimenez, thanks so much for teaching us more about real-world evidence and rare diseases.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's all for today's episode of the Syneos Health Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Stewart from Syneos Health Consulting. If you want to talk through a hard decision you're making at your life sciences company, you may email me at podcast@syneoshealth.com. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. For access to more future-focused, actionable life sciences insights, visit the Syneos Health Insights Hub at insightshub.health. Syneos Health, shortening the distance from lab to life.